First case on our calendar is 05-1635, First Union National Bank of Delaware versus Inez Mailey. Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. At the outset, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
What's your time there on the clock?
If it pleases the court, I believe that this case before us here today involves the reining in of judicial activism in the state of Ohio. We have before us here a statute, Revised Code Section 2317.02, establishing very clearly the attorney-client privilege. A privilege can be waived only by the client's express consent or the executor or fiduciary of that person, should they be deceased, such as the case here, or where the client testifies willingly on that subject. The privilege is waivable only by the client and not by the attorney. This court and all courts should be bound by the statute, that being 2317.02. The court may not alter, amend, or vary a statute. It needs to follow the statute precisely. Anything other than that constitutes impermissible legislation from the bench. What we have here is a problem where we as practicing attorneys need to have the confidence that what's told to us by our clients will remain completely confidential.
Counsel, does it matter what capacity the attorney is holding at the time? Here we have dual capacity.
We do indeed, Your Honor.
Okay, and how do you make a distinction when an attorney is wearing two hats?
The statute doesn't speak to that, and I might point out to the court, I would like to, that this is a very common practice for attorneys to also be administrators, especially in cases like this where we have very poor people, no assets to speak of. A foreclosure was filed against these people by the bank, and what we as attorneys have to do, we have an obligation to these people to represent them fully. There is no bank in this case that would act as a fiduciary. There is no third party where you could practically go. And I don't think that the bank, in this case, Wachovia Bank, is at all prejudiced by the fact that we are asserting the attorney-client privilege. Had Mr. Gensel, had there been assets, had Mr. Gensel had the opportunity to find a third party, the bank couldn't in no wise ever depose Mr. Gensel. There would be a completely different third party fiduciary with no knowledge of the case. If pick a bank, National City Bank, had been chosen by Mr. Gensel as the fiduciary, they would know nothing about the facts of this case. The unfortunate thing here is that the bank is taking advantage of this situation where we have Mr. Gensel in both capacities. And I think that's one of the real problems that we have with the case. They've put us in a position where now they have a leg up on us. And discovery, as we all know under the civil rules, should be a level playing field. We have no level playing field here. One of the problems is, in the Court of Appeals opinion, at paragraph 39 specifically of the appellate decision, the court stated that... Just reading the part of the last sentence of paragraph 39, the waiver necessarily applies to all communications concerning the subject of Mr. Gensel's knowledge of claims and defenses alleged by the state. And here's the real kicker, regardless of when and to whom they were made. Now, Mr. Gensel and I, as co-counsel, have had endless discussions. This would not even limit the bank from taking my deposition next, and I've been nothing but co-counsel for the Mainley family throughout this litigation. This opinion is horrifically overbroad, in my opinion. And I think one of the problems we've got here is some of the appellate courts below have adopted Hearn versus Ray as the standard for determining when the attorney-client privilege is raised. Well, 2317.02 does not allow for a Hearn versus Ray exception. Hearn versus Ray is a federal common law decision. It's a decision that is inapposite to the statutory law of the state of Ohio. Under the federal law, it's strictly common law, and the courts had to struggle, and still the federal courts are not in agreement on this issue. They had to struggle with what do we do in cases of attorney-client privilege because they were unguided by a statute. Here we've got a statute to adopt Hearn versus Ray as an exception, a general exception to Revised Code 23-1702 would, in effect, simply vitiate the statute. And that's not the function of this court or any other court. We have to live with the statute that that was given to us by the legislature. The two cases where this court has, and by this court I mean the Ohio Supreme Court, has found an exception to the attorney-client privilege, as we all know, are Boone versus Van Liner, in which there was a strong dissent, and Moskowitz versus Mount Sinai Medical Center. Both of those cases involved allegations of bad faith or failure to act in good faith. We don't have that here. And what the court found in those cases was that that information, that bad faith information by the carrier, was unworthy of protection. The court did not try to go within 23-1702 and find an exception. They found that to be simply unworthy of protection. And I might point out to this court that in Moskowitz, even in Moskowitz, the court still protected the information which went to the theories of the defense. We don't have this if the court reviews the appellate decision below in paragraphs 37 and 39 of the appellate decision. We don't even have that. We have no protection. I have 11 boxes in this case, 11 file boxes in this case so far. The banks produced 3,000 exhibits. I have a It would be a travesty, it would be an injustice to the Mainleys, it would be an unfairness to the litigation process for the bank to be able to invade my 11 file boxes that I have collected over the last 4 years that we've been litigating this case. And one of the reasons, too, that the courts are very, very hesitant to allow attorney depositions is because what happens is then we do get all bound up in these procedural issues. We get bound up in dealing with those things. This case probably won't go to the merits. We probably won't go to trial for a couple more years. And we've been 4 years down this road already. I think it is an impediment to the entire system
counsel,
to do this.
As a practical matter, the statute 23-1702 allows for the attorney to testify, to disclose, if the executor or administrator of the estate gives approval.
Precisely.
And the executor or administrator here, the administrator, pretty much set up the conflict by being both attorney and administrator. And normally, that's not a problem when there's no controversy, but wouldn't the best or the more prudent thing to do in this case have been to step back, resign as administrator, have an independent administrator to weigh the merits of the controversy, and have your client then retain position as attorney for the estate?
Well, as a practical matter, in cases of states like this where you have basically an insolvent estate,
they have a voluntary system where you can do a pro bono. Every probate court has the ability to appoint.
Well, Your Honor, I still think that it doesn't fit within the confines of the statute. The statute says and doesn't make it. Pro se litigants are common. Attorneys, certainly licensed attorneys, and the defense has cited some pro se cases in support, not the defense, I'm sorry, but the bank has cited some pro se litigation cases to that effect. I think they're inapposite. Those in those pro se cases, you're talking about jailhouse lawyers. Mr. Gensel is a duly licensed attorney in the state of Ohio. The statute within 23-1702 does not accept from that attorneys who are representing themselves in litigation where they are licensed attorneys. And I know of no Ohio case, or for that matter, no case anywhere where there has been carved out this: if you're a licensed attorney representing yourself in a case, that you cannot have that privilege. And
counsel,
and beyond
with respect to the trial court, what's your view of what the trial court ordered? You
the
find
trial
that
court
a,
order?
Yeah,
Your Honor, we were willing to live with the trial court's order as a matter of expedition. We would have lived with the trial court order, and that's why we didn't worry about that. We would have lived with that. I think it's wrong because
the trial court required some response to discovery.
They did, but Judge McGimsey specifically took out of the mix conversations, communications that Mr. Gensel had with Mrs. Mainley while she lived. The Court of Appeals in paragraphs 37 and 39 now would require Mr. Gensel to even disclose all of those things that were told to him by Mrs. Mainley at the time that she lived. That is far and beyond the confines of our statute, which controls attorney-client privilege.
Is the Court of Appeals essentially saying that the lawyer got himself into this situation?
I'm sorry, I cannot
Doesn't the Court of Appeals opinion essentially say the lawyer got himself into this situation, and so the Court of Appeals is going to apply our ruling very, very broadly?
That's precisely what
he said. It's up to the lawyer to sort it out, not up to the courts to try to sort, because you've got the argument about the intertwining. You can't tell which conversations were related to the administrator role and which related to the lawyer-client role. And so if the lawyer gets himself into that situation, then the courts have to try to figure it out. It seems to me the Court of Appeals is saying this is the best we can do. Now, the trial court did it differently, obviously, as you say. But
I think where Judge McGimsey went astray was in implying Hearn versus Ray, a common law federal decision where there's a statute which specifically controls. And I think we have to stay with the statute, Your Honor.
You think that Judge Gimsey's order would rest upon the statute as well as on his?
I do not, Your Honor.
Citing of Hearn.
I do not, and he didn't cite the statute, never mentioned the statute. He mentioned Hearn versus Ray, and just parenthetically, I'm sure that Judge McGimsey was well aware of Hearn versus Ray because he was the lawyer who lost that case in federal court some 30 years ago, and it was an area that he had certain knowledge, direct knowledge about, but I think where he went astray was in applying federal common law from a Washington case to an Ohio situation where we have a statute which controls. And I see that I'm within my 3 minutes, and I would like to reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Wertheim.
Mr. Chief Justice and the court, may it please the court. This is not a case about an abrogation or waiver or limitation on the attorney-client privilege. It's a case about a party being deposed who happens to be an attorney and who is attempting to use the attorney-client privilege to not testify to matters which any other party would have to testify to. Mr. Gensel created these issues for himself.
Well, what specifically?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What specifically are you asking that any other administrator would have to disclose?
Well, Your Honor, this is a fact-specific case because Mr. Gensel has testified, I can't distinguish what I know as an attorney from what I know as the administrator.
Okay, so what is it that you need to know from the administrator?
It would be the same thing you would need to know of any party trying to assert the attorney-client privilege, which is, when was the communication made? What situation was it made in? Where was it made? Who was it made to? Who was present? If I have a communication with a client, Your Honor, in presence of a third party, there is no attorney-client privilege. If I have a communication with my client in front of a court in a trial, there is no attorney-client privilege. He's got to establish the privilege.
What communication are you talking about?
I'm talking about any communication. There is no simple rule that there is a communication between an attorney and a client automatically is privileged. There are many, many areas where there is no privilege.
What is it you want to know? What is it you're asking for?
We're asking for whatever he would know as a party, what information
he has.
Give me
an example. I'm having a hard time understanding.
Why he brought this case, what his basis was for bringing this case. Mrs. Manley was deceased when this case was brought. Mr. Gensel was the party bringing the case. Just like any other party bringing a case, he has to have a basis to bring a case. He was a representative of the estate. He was a class representative bringing class claims. just like any other plaintiff you would depose, you're entitled to know the facts and circumstances and reasons for bringing the case. You can inquire into them on any claim they make, what the basis is for that claim. And Mr. Gensel was required to testify to that, and instead what he did was say, I don't know what I learned when, so I have a privilege.
Doesn't the complaint tell you why he brought the case?
Well, the complaint gives some broad notice pleading like any other complaint in Ohio, but if that was the case, Your Honor, you wouldn't be able to depose
any party.
Your
client really isn't in the dark as to what this case is about, is it?
Yes, Your Honor, it is, because Mrs. Manley was deceased when the case was in its early stages. We didn't get to depose Mrs. Manley and say to her, what is your basis for a fraud allegation? What is your basis for your claims against the bank for doing whatever you're claiming they did? There's nobody else to depose, Your Honor. Mrs. Manley was the only party who could have contained that information, or the party bringing the claims, Mr. Gensel. He had to have some, if you take away the fact that he's an attorney, which is really an irrelevancy to this case, he's a party bringing a case. He has to have a basis for doing it.
Well, how is it that we're able to know that the allegations are that she wasn't creditworthy for this loan, that they got her son, who was mentally incompetent, to co-sign and counted his income in order to make the loan? The bank really isn't in the dark about all of that, is it?
Well, it's not in the dark as to what it did. It's in the dark as to what the party, who in this case is Mr. Gensel, claims it did wrong. And that's the basis of deposing Mr. Gensel, Your Honor. He was not in the, we are not deposing him as a lawyer. We have not asked for Mr. Martin's deposition. That's not what this case is about. It is not an attempt to depose an attorney. It's an attempt to depose a party.
Well, the trial court did allow some discovery, did it?
It did, Your Honor.
And what was wrong with the trial court's order?
Well, there were two problems, Your Honor. One, it was made a final appealable order so that if we attempted to depose Mr. Gensel and got back into where the lines were drawn on this case, we conceivably could have been barred from proceeding further. But the bigger problem was Mr. Gensel said, I can't distinguish what I did as an attorney, what I learned as an attorney, from what I learned as the administrator. And that testimony, that fact-specific testimony to this case, prohibits him from asserting a privilege, because in order to have a privilege, you've got to establish the facts of a privilege. A communication between an attorney and the client in the course of a representation.
And why does that entitle you to communication as an attorney between him and his clients before they died?
Well, the problem
is, that line seems like a very clear line. They were attorney and they were a client at that point. Why is that open to your discovery?
It wouldn't be, Your Honor, if Mr. Gensel was able to say, I learned this from Mrs. Manley and in the course of my communications with her.
Had he brought a class action at that point before she died?
There had been no claims against the bank before she died.
So he was not a party at that point, and she was his client, and he was not administrator. So why should that extend back into a clear attorney-client communication before her death, when there was no lawsuit, no party, no administrator conflicts?
It goes there, Your Honor, because Mr. Gensel can't draw that line. If Mr. Gensel were able to testify, if he had testified,
we certainly could draw that line for him if he was an attorney and she was a client, and there was no other relationship. That line seems very easy to draw from a legal standpoint.
If Mr. Gensel could come in and say, I learned X from Mrs. Manley, we could not inquire into it. But his testimony was, I can't tell you what I learned when.
So your argument seems not so much that there's a conflict between him as administrator and his role as an attorney for the estate, which is a very common occurrence in estates that are administered. Your argument seems to go to his role as a party plaintiff. That is where you seem to be deriving your need to dispose of the current client privilege, is that he was a party plaintiff, so he had a third role in this situation. Am I getting that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that as wearing the attorney hat, he can't distinguish what he knew as an attorney, from what he knew as the administrator, from what he knew in any other capacity. So if Mr. Gensel had come in and said, I can't tell you that because I only know that from Mrs. Manley, we would not be able to inquire in that. But his testimony was, I can't distinguish what I learned when, and therefore I'm not telling you anything because everything is privileged.
Did he answer that to every question you asked or just to certain questions?
Every substantive question. So in fact, we believe that not only is there no issue here of attorney-client privilege waiver in reality, but that Mr. Gensel really hasn't even established that there's any privilege material and can't establish that there's any privilege material. And we believe that's what the Court of Appeals decided this case on, not on a waiver or an abrogation of the statute.
Although counsel at paragraph 36, they are specifically saying we find an implied waiver based on these facts. Is that, I mean, this is what concerns me. And do you see this as being a problem for future representation of individuals, attorneys, who then function as fiduciaries in situations like this?
No, Your Honor, I don't, because, well, I mean, first of all, it's probably a problematic situation for an attorney to place himself in. But if an attorney decides to place himself in this role of wearing multiple hats, that attorney needs to be careful and cognizant of his different roles and know what he learned, what his communications with his client, know what he's learned and what his role was as a party, and keep those two separate. I mean, this happens very often, Your Honor, in the corporate world where it's not even the attorney's a party, but the attorney may be a director and an attorney and sits on a board meeting and is called to be deposed at a deposition, and he says attorney-client privilege, and there's an issue of whether he was there as a director or as an attorney and what his role was. And when the attorney can't distinguish those roles, courts have almost unanimously held there is no privilege. You cannot hide behind the privilege to not testify to things that are clearly in your role as a non-attorney.
So it sounds as if you want us to affirm the decision below, but for a different reason, if I understand you correctly.
Well,
we're not talking about implied waiver the way the Court of Appeals was.
I think the Court of Appeals used that term, Your Honor, and maybe used it a little loosely. If you excuse me. If you look at the Hearn test, Mr. Gensel's actions do constitute an implied waiver. But you don't even have to get to that test because he testified, and I think the Court of Appeals opinion is very clear as to its basis, that his testimony was, I can't distinguish my roles, and that's what the Court of Appeals below based their decision on. It's his inability to really establish an attorney-client privilege, not a waiver. There are often times when courts, and even this court in the Boone, has trouble called, sometimes it's called an exception, sometimes it says there is no attorney-client privilege, and sometimes the court calls it a waiver. But this is not a situation where there is an established attorney-client privilege and the court is saying there's a waiver because of something else.
Should we follow Hearn, or should we use Hearn as our guide here, or should we use the statute as our guide?
I don't think you have to use either, Your Honor, because the statute, like I said, there is no attorney-client privilege here based upon Mr. Gensel's testimony.
Well, assuming that we think there is, and trying to set some, this case has to be significant for some legal principle. I'm not sure I know exactly yet what it is, but because, and it may be a review of Hearn, which we cited before. Is that the value of this case, that we can tell the bench and the bar Hearn is the law or the statute? We're going to follow the statute instead of Hearn?
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, I think this is a case about what an individual attorney did. I don't think there is a problem following Hearn because Hearn applies in a very limited situation where, as in this case, Mr. Gensel has placed himself and the issues into the lawsuit and is now trying to hide behind an attorney-client.
But I'm hearing everyone is saying, I think agreeing, that this is common for a lawyer to act both as a a lawyer to a client and then the administrator of the estate. So is this a common problem or not?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know if it's a common problem or not. It doesn't, whether
issue,
attorneys
sir.
Create this problem, it doesn't make it a right way to behave. And I think that any attorney in any scenario that places himself as both the party and attorney has a very distinct problem of claiming attorney-client privilege. I don't think an attorney who places himself in that role is often going to get away with claiming an attorney-client privilege to not testify to facts that any other party would have to testify to.
I guess the difficulty is we're presented with a case in which the trial court did its best. Yeah, the trial court obviously was trying to discern one from the other with somewhat inartfully, because it's difficult with Mr. Gensel taking the position he did to do that. Court of Appeals said, well, it's your problem, lawyer. You created this problem, and so we're going to just write a broad opinion. Now, where do we come down on that for the bench and the bar?
Well, I think the answer, Your Honor, is
we come down on
that, excuse me, where an attorney creates that problem for himself and cannot distinguish his role as an attorney from his role as a party, then he has no privilege.
Even though the trial judge has attempted to do precisely that for the parties.
Well, the problem with the trial judge's attempt, Your Honor, was Mr. Gensel's testimony that I can't distinguish one role from another. The trial court's opinion would have worked, but for that testimony. In light of that testimony, it could not work because Mr. Gensel's already said he can't distinguish the roles. So if he can't distinguish them, how is any of his communications or any of his knowledge going to be protected by the attorney-client privilege?
Opposing counsel has suggested that you want to go through his co-counsel's 13 boxes of work product on this case. True or untrue?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure we ever got to that point because we don't know what Mr. Gensel
it's
has.
It's a simple question.
We've never seen it, but we would ask for Mr. Gensel's file. And if there were communications from Mr. Martin, those would obviously be privileged. But anything else Mr. Gensel gathered in his role as a party would be discoverable.
Well, counsel, not necessarily so. There's certainly provisions for an in-camera inspection by the court as far as letters or communications as an attorney, and you're not looking for those.
No, Your Honor, we're not looking for his communications with his counsel. If he had a communication with Mr. Martin.
Or with the decedent in clearly a legal capacity, if that can be exerted, and the court determines that, that's not subject to your scrutiny. Would you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. If it was actually proven that it was in that capacity and it was a written communication.
And the court would be able to do that, to do an in-camera inspection of any documents in controversy to establish that.
Certainly. We were in the deposition stage, though, Your Honor, asking questions,
that.
Not in the document stage.
I understand that.
Yes.
Isn't really the first premise or predicate to this entire discussion is the third prong of the Hearn test, that is basically this information is not available from any other source.
Yes, Your Honor, that's a very important prong.
We don't even have to have this discussion.
Well, I'm not sure we wouldn't have the discussion because there's another source doesn't mean that you can't depose another party with information. Again, we're treating this as an attorney being asked to testify, which is not what's happening here. We're asking for a party to testify who happens to be an attorney. And that's where the problem lies, is that if I file a lawsuit, I can't go in and claim attorney-client privilege for everything I know about that lawsuit simply because I'm an attorney. And that's really where the problem lies here, is that a party refuses to testify and try and take the privilege to a place where it doesn't belong, and then testified, I can't distinguish what I know as an attorney and what I know as a party, and therefore I'm not telling you anything.
What I'm curious about is, say you went through the whole discovery process and there was a trial, and the plaintiff would have to take the stand, I would imagine. I can't imagine how they would establish their basis for the lawsuit without that. And wouldn't the same information be asked on the stand that are subject matter of a deposition, presumably?
Exactly, Your Honor, and that's our problem. We don't have Mrs. Manley to depose. We have the party who was Mr. Gensel. Mr. Ball, who's the current administrator, obviously knows nothing. He was selected by Mr. Gensel to take over, and that's the situation we're faced with, is we don't know why this lawsuit, what's the basis of this lawsuit.
Thank you, Mr. Werthan.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Martin, you saved a little more than 2.5 minutes of your time.
If it pleases the court, Mrs. Manley is dead. It happens in lots of cases. It's an unfortunate fact of life. The bank shouldn't be able to take advantage of the fact that Mrs. Manley is dead and her son is a poor mentally retarded person, that they have a factual problem.
Well, counsel, could I just start with the last question that I asked opposing counsel? And presumably you get to trial, and wouldn't Attorney Gensel have to take the stand in order to establish the elements of the fraud and the underlying conduct and at least the what happened on the plaintiff's side here?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. All of those facts are established by the bank's records. And that the bank has all of the records on this case. We don't, Your Honor. I mean, the case involves a loan of $68,500 on a $33,000 house where people were living on $390 a month. It's a predatory lending case. And the class action part of the case, just so the court understands, the class action part of this case, is the allegation is very simple. We're alleging that this bank charged people for appraisals that it never did. Now, the bank has all those records. We don't have the records of all the people in Ohio for whom they did this, quote, in-house evaluation. The bank knows who they charged for appraisals that they never did. We do not have that information. Even if the court adopted Hearn versus Ray, the third prong of Hearn versus Ray at page 581 of the opinion is specifically that application of the privilege would have denied the opposing party access to information vital to his defense. Under Hearn versus Ray, vital doesn't mean convenient. Vital means indispensable. There's been no showing, to my knowledge, of indispensability. We simply have here, as in many cases I said before, a person who is deceased, and that's unfortunate. I think what the court needs to do is to revisit and reaffirm the court's holding in State versus McDermott. And that in that case, our court, or this Supreme Court, stated, just give me a minute. It stated, as we decline to add a judicially created waiver to the statutorily created privilege, we hold that Revised Code 2317.02 provides the exclusive means by which privileged communications between an attorney and a client can be waived. That's where we need to be. If we get into Hearn versus Ray, we're vitiating the statute, we're creating a slippery slope that neither the bench or bar is going to ever be able to understand. How do I know when to tell my client when my client walks in my door what you say may or can be used against you? We don't want to go that direction. If the court needs to create a bright line test in this case, that bright line test has to be within the confines of the statute. Yes, there's some information unworthy of protection, a la Moskovitz. Yes, there's some information unworthy of protection, a la Boone versus Vantliner. Yes, there is some information where there's malpractice, where obviously the communications between the lawyer and his client, a legal malpractice case, are the issue before the case. And yes, in the attorney-client crime fraud situation, there is a need to get that information. But we're back to the vitality issue.
You need to sum up your red lights, son. You need to sum up your argument.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.